Guy Deacon, it is brilliant to have you on the 20 Questions with podcast. I'd go so far as to say it's a privilege because we spoke very recently at the Oxford Literary Festival and I was hugely inspired by your story. I think a story that can unite us all at a fractious time when there is so much division. You were in the British Army for the best part of about 35 years. And when you were 49, still in the army, you were diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And yet, towards the end of 2022, you returned to Britain, having left the army from a trip that involved, in two stages, because it was interrupted by the pandemic, driving from the North African coast along the western coast of Africa to Cape Town on the southern point of Africa. It was an incredible achievement. It would have been an incredible achievement for someone who wasn't suffering from Parkinson's. And I should say that your book is out and it's called Running on Empty, 18,000 miles down Africa with Parkinson's. A very warm welcome to you. Have I got any of that wrong?
No, that's all about right. Thank you very much.
What motivated you to get going in the first place? You were in Sierra Leone when the pandemic struck and you were forced to return to Britain. I know there was a separate motivation when you then went back to continue your journey, but to begin with, what was on your mind?
I was wondering what to do when I retired anyway, and I knew I couldn't get a proper job because I have certain things I can't do. I can't demand a proper salary for my time because I rely upon other people to help me do any work. And the army was extremely generous to me, and I didn't expect any other employer to be quite so good. So I had to think of something to do. And it was going to give me headspace to go and work out where I wanted to come back to and how I was going to settle my life down and get used to not being able to do things I want to do. And I still had enough energy and enough gumption to get up and complete a journey that I've been dreaming about since I was at school. So I was going to go and do this, whatever happened, and see what happened next, really. It was a bit of an open-ended sort of discussion with myself, and I wasn't quite sure what I'd be doing next after that.
I want to jump ahead of that first stage of the trip, and of course, we'll come back to it so that you can explain to us what was motivating you in part by the time you resumed your journey.
Well, when we were all locked down in the UK, of course, it wasn't a complete lockdown. We could get around a bit. And I met Omotola Thomas, who runs Parkinson's Africa, and I met Rob Hayward, who makes films. And the combination of meeting him and deciding to make a film and meeting Omotola and realizing just what was going on in Africa in terms of Parkinson's suddenly became a real cause worth pursuing. And I realized that actually I could use what I was doing for myself as a vehicle to raise awareness of what other people were going through in Africa in particular and the hardships they were suffering. And to draw attention to that, and also to prove to other people back in the UK that just because you've got Parkinson's, it doesn't mean to say you have to stop doing things. You can still carry on, however difficult things might be. And that's really what I want to do, those two things. And actually to fulfill my dream.
Just explain to us the awareness that you were trying to bring in countries in Africa. Was there a taboo? What was the approach of some towards the disease?
Well, the first thing is it's not everywhere. Some countries are very sort of ordinary and straightforward and they recognize it for what it is, but in many places they don't because they've got other problems to worry about as well. But Parkinson's manifests itself in a very unpleasant sort of way. Individuals are either very still and static and can't join in what's going on and they seem to be gripped by something or seized by something, or else they're shaking and vibrant and wobbling all over the place and tremoring and they have no control over themselves. That's equally bad. And because there's no known cause as such, and there's no cure. People just have this disease, and it's very, very unpleasant. And people therefore think people are possessed and they must be cursed, they must have something wrong. And traditional medicines and traditional healers don't know what the answer is, of course. And they just turn around and say, well, there must be some sort of curse on you, and we have to leave you to get on with it. And that's exactly what happens in some places. People are abandoned to their fate. Families don't look after their own, and they sometimes feed them, but they sometimes don't. And people are left to live a horrible, lonely life. And it's horrible in those circumstances. And it need not happen because they just don't know what Parkinson's is about.
You say there's no cause. I mean, am I right in thinking that work is being done, research is being done into trying to work out whether there is as it were, an environmental cause, and if there is, what could be done about it?
There are two options. There's environmental factors and organophosphates and pesticides are one option. I used to work in a vehicle which used to have shell cases when you fire the gun, which would produce lots of smoke inside the turret. People said that might cause it, but it probably doesn't. So there are reasons it could be, but nobody's actually proved that to be the case. And there's lots of research going into it. And it could be genetic. When it's unlikely to be genetic because it comes up in different ways. I don't have any history in my family. And I hope it's not genetic because I don't want my children to have it. But that's something that people are looking at as well. So nobody quite knows for sure, but that will, by knowing what the cause is, then people can work out what the cure is. And that's why there's so much work going into finding out what the cause is as well.
Could you let us know what it was like as a 49-year-old British Army officer being diagnosed with Parkinson's?
In a funny way, it was a bit of a relief because I knew there wasn't something. There's something that wasn't quite right when I came back from the Congo. I'd had a fairly interesting 18 months there, and I was very tired, very worn out when I returned. I wasn't sort of shocked and worried, but I was very tired and very thin, and had a very interesting time. So I was not my normal self, and it took a doctor about 5 seconds to determine what I had, the neurologist, because it's so obvious when you know what to look for. But because I thought it was something else, I was actually quite relieved. It wasn't a brain tumor. It wasn't worse. And the doctor said, take the pills and you'll be fine. Just carry on doing what you're doing. And I was extremely lucky because the army carried on employing me and paying me the same amount of money, putting me in jobs I could do and jobs I want to do, more importantly, for a full-time career. So I didn't have to worry about the inability to work or anything. I could carry on almost as normal and ignore it. And I was kind of in denial, if the truth be known, as well. I pretended it wasn't happening to me.
Just tell us what you'd been doing in the Congo, because it was really interesting and, on the face of it at least, dangerous work.
I think it might have been more dangerous than I realised. What I was doing, I was disarming rebels. The Eastern Congo is full of people who shouldn't really be there and are causing trouble because it's a very complicated part of the world. It borders on Uganda and Rwanda, and so there are rebel groups harbouring themselves up in Congo to keep out of Uganda, and harbouring themselves up in Congo to keep out of Rwanda, where they originally came from. And the Congolese army is not actually very strong, so the rebel groups are quite strong. But there's a strong case for getting to hand themselves in and to be repatriated to their original countries. And I was part of the team working for the UN, funded by the British, to try and get these people to hand themselves in, hand in their weapons, and be demobilized and go back home again. And it was a fascinating business because, of course, these people had a terrible reputation. And I met people who had killed their brothers and fathers and goodness knows what. When you met them, they're actually fairly ordinary people and had very problems of their own and were actually much more interesting than you think. So it was probably quite dangerous, but if you managed it properly, I never felt threatened by them at all.
What did that teach you about humanity, that experience?
Life is always more complicated than you think. The snapshot never tells you the full story. You hear about these people and how dreadful they are, but actually there's a reason why they're doing what they're doing, and they're protecting their own interests as much as anything else, and they have a reason for being anti-government or anti-local population or whatever it happens to be. And if you treat them in different ways, you'll get different responses. If you take them on head on, they all become belligerent and try and protect their own interests, and they don't. That's not necessarily the right answer. If you talk to them and negotiate with them, you'll discover they've got a different sort of reason for doing what they're doing, and you can negotiate and sort of persuade them to think differently. But it takes time, and it takes patience.
Which isn't to exculpate them
No.
if they've done horrific things. It's about understanding them, presumably, so that you can fulfill your mission.
Yeah, people are always hung up about the genocide that took place in Rwanda, but that was 1994, a long time ago. So these are the children of genocidaires who are still members of the armed groups, and they weren't guilty themselves of propping up Hutus and Tutsis. They're just wrapped up in the whole process, and they've got used to living in the conditions that they have, and they aren't necessarily guilty themselves. They're just part of an organization which is a terrorist organization. And if you deal with them in that respect, then you realize they're just on one side of the fence rather than the other. They could be FARDC, they could be army, but instead they just happen to be rebel troops. They're all sort of doing the same sort of thing from different angles.
Do you think you would have even, I mean, this is perhaps a difficult question to answer, but do you think you would have even considered, I know this was a long-held dream, but would you in reality have considered driving the length of Africa with Parkinson's had you not served for those decades in the British Army with all that that equipped you with in terms of your approach and your abilities?
It's a good question, and I'm not quite sure what the answer is. I was lucky enough as a young officer to be exposed to what goes on in Africa and to get some feel for it and to realize that people are fairly normal, really, and are trustworthy and reliable if you treat them in the right way. And I was in the army, I was a troop leader and a squadron leader and a commanding officer, so I had people who worked for me, and you can motivate people to work in certain ways. So I was fairly confident in my own ability to get things done with people I hadn't met before and to find my way through rather awkward situations. Because you can do that just by negotiating. You can't, however well armed you are, you can't fight your way through things. You've got to talk your way th through things most of the time. And I've done that a lot in my previous life. So doing that through Africa was going to be a fairly straightforward way of dealing with problems I came across, I thought. But importantly, I didn't think I'd come across that many problems. I was fairly naive in some ways. I didn't expect to be troubled too often. And if I did, I assumed that people would be ordinary like me and they'd have a reason for stopping me. They probably wanted money, they wanted to make themselves a bit richer, and they saw this big, shiny vehicle driving through, lots of good stuff inside. Why wouldn't they try and nick things from me? And as far as I was concerned, if they nick things, that wasn't a problem. If they chop me up, that'd be a different issue altogether. But things are just things. Vehicle's just a vehicle. And as long as they don't kill me or damage me, that wouldn't be a problem, really.
Just tell us where you started and describe the vehicle for us and roughly what you had in it.
Right, it's a fairly standard VW camper van. That's the first thing. To look at, you wouldn't see any difference, but it's been improved in certain ways. First of all, it's four-wheel drive, and secondly, it was armored underneath, so I could drive across rocks and boulders and not worry too much about what I hit underneath. The suspension was upgraded, which it needed to be, but not quite upgraded enough. And inside, it was an ordinary camper van with a rock and roll bed, a roof that goes up, a little sink, a little cooker, a little fridge, heaters, and goodness knows what. Exactly like you have grey-haired people in England driving around in all over the place, but I was doing it through Africa. And I've seen people doing it before, and I thought, well, that's what I want to do it in. And in a funny way, it was the ideal vehicle, primarily because I could live inside it rather than outside it. If I had a pickup truck, I would have to live outside, and therefore you're always sort of open to the elements and open to people coming and nicking things off you. But I could just shut the door and do anything I wanted inside the vehicle, and could protect myself if I needed to.
And where did you start?
Started in Morocco, drove down through the Western Sahara, which is of course really part of Morocco nowadays, but we don't really say that. Into Mauritania, hugging the coast all the way to Senegal, which was my first sort of long stop, where I waited to get visas for Guinea and Guinea-Bissau.
What was Mauritania like?
Well, I wish I could have spent more time there, because actually it's a fascinating country. It was one of those countries that was always difficult to get to, and nobody ever went there in the old days. But I was rather hoping I'd have met up with some fellow travellers, but there weren't any at all. So I was totally alone going through Mauritania. Otherwise, I would have turned left and gone into the desert and had a good old explore and driven around some dunes, because that's what I love doing. But I didn't really dare do that by myself in traveling alone, because if I had come unstuck, I'd be there for weeks, if not years, never found. And I thought that would have been irresponsible, to say the least.
How did you decide where to stop for the night? And did you leave the road in order to, in your view, be safer?
Well, to begin with, through the desert, where there is nobody, you can find place to stay very easily. You just literally pull off the road and just drive as far as you want to go, so you can't be seen. And sometimes I'd drive 4 or 5 miles off the road, so my lights wouldn't be seen. And then I'd just turn the engine off, have a listen, have a watch, make sure nothing's going, pop the roof up, and then I'd stay there for the night, watch the sun go down, and love it. And that was a great pleasure and a great freedom to do. And I could put the music on, put the deck chair out, read my book, and just have a great evening. And that was almost a, that was my pleasure. Where there's more people around, you have to be a bit more careful, because they will always come up and say hello. Now, sometimes that's fine, but sometimes that can be a bit obtrusive, and they can be a bit sort of too inquisitive, and you don't want to trouble them. So if that was the case, I would often go and find a police post or an army post or whatever was on the road, and I'd say, "Can I camp about next door to you?" And they'd nearly always say yes. They wouldn't mind at all. So I set up camp literally by a roadblock, and they would keep me quiet, and they would look after me.
How were you navigating and what was your connectivity like? Were you always able to use your mobile phone?
There are three things which have changed as I first went. First of all, is mobile phones are nearly everywhere, not quite. So one of the drills was to buy a new SIM card every time I went into a new country. So I'd buy up the SIM card and log on to the local network. And that meant I could use a GPS, and I could use WhatsApp, and I could email people back home with some difficulty. But connectivity was incredible and really, really useful. And it meant that map reading was relatively straightforward. I didn't use a paper map at all, hardly, apart from a bit of planning. And I'd follow GPS where necessary. But there's only one or two roads you can never take. And if you hug the coastline, you can't go too far wrong.
There are lots of photographs of you, aren't there, on this trip with the people that you met along the way. How did you get those photographs taken? And were you, as it were, traveling on your own for the whole journey on both legs?
To begin with, I had a friend come out for 2 weeks where we just messed around in the desert having a lovely time. And then I left him and carried on through the Western Sahara and Mauritania and down to Senegal by myself. There are an awful lot of photographs of the van without anybody in it that's taken by me. There's an awful lot of photographs taken with a tripod or two, a lot of a dash cam and that sort of stuff. So to begin with, I was largely by myself nearly all the time. Well, after I met Rob Hab, the filmmaker, he came out 3 or 4 times separately. And towards the end, he was with me a lot because I was getting more and more difficult to drive. And he ended up driving me as well as filming a lot of the time. So I was dependent upon him to look after me because things were getting that much more difficult. So after a while, I had somebody traveling with me much more often.
What was Senegal like?
Lovely. It's very modern. It's very French, very chic, very progressive, brilliant music, good cuisine, and good climate, and really good fun. And I knew a few people there beforehand. So I stayed there for about 4 weeks in total while I got visas done for Guinea and Guinea-Bissau. And Dakar is a great city. St. Louis up in the north, Port Louis, I mean, is a very colourful ex-capital up near the border, near the west, near Mauritania. And it's just a fun place to be. And there's quite a lot of ex-French people there who are very hospitable. And so it was fine dining, music evenings, really good fun.
Guinea-Bissau, I think, is a very poor country, isn't it? But some beautiful beaches, am I right in saying? And
Yes.
what was it like trying to get into Cameroon, because that was a trickier, to say the least, experience, wasn't it?
Well, Cameroon was a lot later, and that was when I returned after COVID, and it was fascinating actually because I was tested in every possible way. First of all, I was in Nigeria, and Nigeria has a very bad reputation for crime and for trouble and for population and for people sort of nicking things and goodness knows what. And I was advised not to go there by somebody from Nigeria to do whatever you can to avoid it. You know, take a boat around and go cut across the Bight of Benin, which would have been a bit of a cop out. But I was lucky that somebody heard about me through the internet and said, "You must come and stay with me, and I will look after you." A chap called Tim Hepburn, and he and another fellow called Tim Illingworth, who ran a private security company, agreed to look after me without me even having anything to do with it. So they met me at the border, escorted me to Lagos, looked after me while I was there, while I got my visa sorted out, and helped me plan the way out, which was easier said than done because the border with Cameroon is closed. The north is Boko Haram and very dangerous. The south is an Anglophile separatist group because there's also trouble in Cameroon between the French and the English speaking communities. And it's not simply language, it's much more than that. And security forces are having real trouble in the south of the border. And there's a gap in the middle where nobody goes. And there's no road to speak of either. But that's where some tourists had gone not so, a little bit before me. And I managed to persuade the ambassador to Cameroon that it was possible. And Tim Illingworth provided me with some guides and guards, armed guards, and she was convinced by me that it was safe enough. So we set off from Gembu to Banyo, which was an extraordinary route. It was like a goat track across the hills. And one way or another, we didn't quite get it right, and I lost a clutch along the way. Whether it was my fault, whether it was the driver's fault, I'm not quite sure. It doesn't really matter. But I ended up being towed across the border by a Nigerian in his ex-Nigerian Army Pinscar, up and down Dale, until we got to Gembu, Abanyo in Cameroon 3 days later. And it was quite a moment, I can assure you, because I was clutches are rare in Africa and very rare of the VW. So I had to get the vehicle down to Yaoundé, which I did on the back of a cattle truck, where I got some bits flown out to me and had them repaired there.
Just to retrace your tracks for a moment, if we go back to Sierra Leone, you very nearly had to stay in Sierra Leone during the pandemic, didn't you? You nearly didn't get out to go back to Britain.
Well, at the time, I was actually prepared to stay as well. I was slightly low on drugs, but I could get some flown out to the British Embassy through the embassy, and that would be all right. But we all thought the pandemic would last 3 or 4 months or whatever it would be. And at the time, you might remember Italy had it very badly. It was creeping through France and arriving in England, and the news was all very, very grim about people getting it in England and the UK. And in Africa, meanwhile, it wasn't there at all. They were their control measures were brilliant because they know about Ebola and they know about infectious diseases. So everywhere you went, you wash your hands and you're queuing, you're keeping your distances and everything. And they were very under control. But I was advised that if there was a problem and I was to catch it, then the hospital system is not very good in Sierra Leone, and I'd be better off in the UK, which was probably sound advice. So I bought a ticket on Air France to come back, and then of course the flight was cancelled. And a week later, I was on a UK EU emergency evacuation flight with lots of other people to get me back out of Africa, thinking I'll be back in 3 months' time.
Once you were in Cameroon, was it beautiful? And can you give us a sense generally of the shifting landscapes on that western side of Africa? Because I can imagine that some of those views that you must have had along the way were absolutely sensational in very different ways.
It's completely different to East Africa and South Africa, which people know, or Southern Africa, which people know. There aren't the great plains and the herds of animals and wildebeest, lots of stuff that you get in Kenya and Tanzania and Zambia and Zimbabwe. It's just not like that at all. It's either desert and Sahel, which I love, but I love the dryness of the desert and the dunes going right into the sea's edge, or it's primary forest, or it would be primary forest if they weren't cutting it all down. There's a lot of logging going on, and that's a major issue, of course. But the trees are glorious, and some of the roads go wind through the trees, and they're beautiful. So on a daily basis, you could when you're doing the mile, you can see the circle, the environment around you changing, and you literally move from shrubs to trees to bushes to woods to forests to thick forests, muddy roads, and then it starts getting better again when you get to Angola, where it dries out again. Back down to shrubs, back down to small plants, back down to small numbers of trees, and then you're into Namibia, which is desert again. And you can see the whole world unfolding in front of you. It's glorious.
And Cameroon itself?
Cameroon is Well, I spent most of my time traveling in a Mercedes truck with my vehicle on the back being towed down. It was wet and rainy and very potholy, and we did a lot of traveling very slowly throughout the day and the night. But it was beautiful. But not many people get to Cameroon because the roads aren't very good.
I can imagine that the desert in Namibia was beautiful both by day and by night.
One thing I tried to do, and I failed time and time again, was to take photographs of the stars. Luckily, it gets dark quite early, and it takes me a long time to do anything. So I was always up and about till quite late at night, just tootling around doing bits and pieces. And if I had nothing better to do, I would set up a camera or two and desperately try and take pictures of the stars, which were glorious. But I just couldn't do it. I just didn't have the skills to get the right settings. And I took lots of black photographs of nothing in particular, or little tiny dots. But the stars you can see are fantastic. But I couldn't photograph to save my life.
But Namibia, was that beautiful, the desert there?
Yes. The deserts are not all sand dunes. There are some beautiful sand dune areas, which are very well known. So most of it's just rocky, flat, mountainous, hilly, challenging environment. But you can see for miles, and the roads are very straight. You can see they go for 10 kilometers in a row. And you can see where you're going for miles, miles, miles. It's really great.
One of the assets I think that you feel helped you was your patience. You decided you were going to take your time and you needed patience. For example, when you were trying to get a visa or if something went wrong with the vehicle. Can you give us a sense of whether it was harder or less challenging overall than you'd expected? And how dangerous was it? I know you'll be modest, but I mean, how much luck did you have to emerge unscathed, and what sort of shape was the vehicle in by the end?
I think I was extremely lucky. I think I started off extremely naively. I thought it'd be dead easy, and I thought, what could go wrong? As long as I sort of kept my wits about me and drove down the roads and didn't get too lost and didn't upset people, they'd be fine. And that was my general modus operandi, is not to irritate people and not to wind them up, but just to go with the flow because I had time. But I think I was very naive, and I was very lucky. I got away with a lot. I had three or four instances when the vehicle could have been in deep trouble. Once I was overtaking a vehicle, and suddenly around the corner came another lorry in the other direction. And how I got between the two of them, I don't know. That caused quite a stir. So that was the first occasion I thought, bloody hell, I better be a bit careful here. I don't like that. Secondly, I drove off the road on one occasion. Everybody says gravel is very slippery, and I know gravel is very slippery, but I felt the vehicle sliding away, and I wasn't going fast, I promised, Governor. But I just felt it drifting towards the end of the track, and I steered over the track so I wouldn't go over sideways because I just thought it better to go head on than side on. Then that was another lucky call when I was blessed, I think. And if, on another occasion, I was traveling on the road, and the road suddenly narrowed without much warning, and I hit the side of the road and damaged two wheels quite badly because the road was suddenly normal width and suddenly got very narrow as it approached a bridge. And so that was a bit of a thump. But so on those three occasions, I could have had a lot worse than I was. And on each occasion, because I was all right, because the wagon was more or less all right, it wasn't a problem. I just had to fix it and carry on. And that's my sort of, if you can carry on doing things, then you're all right. If nobody's hurt, then everything's fine. Just got to fix it and get on with it.
And from a sort of crime perspective or encountering dangerous human beings, how iffy was that part of it?
I used to keep my windows wound up in traffic jams in big cities because I didn't want people to see me pilfering things. There was only one occasion when I was talking to somebody through a window that a chap put his hand in through the window and stole some notes from the glove the door, door pocket, and that was my own fault. But I was always just wary to keep the window not too far down. But most people are like you and me. They're not going to nick things on purpose. Most people are very friendly and just are fascinated and interested in what you're doing. And if you assume they're the same as you and me, then why are they going to nick anything? They're not.
Final question to you, and we could go on for far longer, but I'm going to stick roughly to the rules. What did the experience? I'm going to have to weave in a couple of questions and slightly cheat. What did the journey overall teach you about yourself that perhaps you didn't already know? And what did it teach you about humanity? And will you do something similar again? And what does your wife make of it all?
What it teaches me about myself, I learned that I can't do the things I used to do. I learned that I'm now over 60 years old. I am grey-haired. I am not a grandfather yet, but I'm that sort of. I'm the wrong side of 60 to be doing this sort of stuff. It's a young man's business, and I needed to be realistic. I needed to recognize things I couldn't do that I used to be able to do in the past. That's a very painful lesson to learn, because you think you can carry on as you were, and suddenly you realize you can't. So that was the first thing. And along the way, there were certain things I couldn't do towards the end that I could do at the beginning. You know, changing a tire, they each weigh about 40 kilos, those tires and wheels. And getting off the back and maneuvering and everything is really quite hard work. And when you're a bit weak, as I am, you suddenly think, oh, this is, I don't want to do this every day because I can't. When things were broken, you know, getting all the fixing everything was much more difficult than it had been before. Operating a screwdriver, all the fine details which come, which go with Parkinson's, is really frustrating. So there are things I couldn't do, and it took me forever, forever to do simple jobs. Putting a plug in, putting a USB plug into a USB socket, whatever it happens to be, really trying. And that was frustrating, but I learned that I couldn't do the things I used to do. Simple as that. Secondly, almost everywhere I went, there were people who were willing to help. And all you have to do is ask for help. And it's human nature to want to offer help. I know we all feel, I feel good helping other people. It's a self-fulfilling thing, really, more than anything else. If you help them, you feel good about yourself. And people do want to help you. And I needed a lot of help as I was going along. And people were very kind to me. And wherever I was, there were people who turned around and said, they helped me out in all sorts of ways. So it was fabulous. And I was very careful not to abuse that help, because you can't rely upon it, but it is there. And if you need help, and people will give it to you, and you've just got to give into it and not be proud, not be stubborn. And not make life more difficult for yourself by doing it yourself. And sometimes I did that, and I spent hours doing things which somebody would have helped me do, and it would take seconds. So that's the other thing. People will always help you and want to help you because they feel good about it. And would I do it again? The answer is I'd love to do it again. I would try and do it again, but I know that I couldn't do it again the same way unless I spent a lot of time, and I haven't got that much time. You know, on a daily basis, I reckon I'm good for about 2 hours when I can operate normally. 2 hours when I can operate, but not normally, and 2 hours when I can't really operate at all, depending on how the pill's working and what time of day it is. So it takes me a long time to do what takes other people a short time to do. And I'm not sure I've got that much time, really. It would take me forever to do the things I wanted to do. And a lot of time waiting to recover, lying on the floor, just recovering.
And your wife?
She's pretty resigned to the way I behave, I would like to say. She's remarkably good at looking after me and looking after the family, and we're all fairly robust, and she has an active life of her own as well, and she would hate it if I was hanging around the home just being doing nothing useful. So she'd much rather I was out and about doing what I want to do than wishing I was doing it and not doing it.
Well, as I said in my introduction, Guy, it's a really inspiring story. And of course, I'm not recommending people just fly over or take the boat over to North Africa and start it for themselves, because you come from a very serious background of decades in the army, and you're clearly a formidable human being. But nonetheless, I think your odyssey really can serve to inspire so many to overcome obstacles of different natures in life. And we all face obstacles at certain points. And listening to someone who's maybe perhaps the right word is to say you embraced your diagnosis and you've continued to make the very most of life. And it's a really wonderful and heartwarming story to listen to. And I'm very grateful to you for sharing it with us.
No, well, thank you very much for your time. And let's see what happens next. Watch this space.